So I'm going to talk about X chromosome inactivation and the contribution of the non-coding genome to these processes. And I will start by showing you human karyotypes. So what you can see on this slide are two karyotypes, one for female cells and one for the male cells. And as you can see, these two karyotypes look alike very much, especially for what concerns the first two pairs of chromosomes, which are the autosomes from 1 to 22, and which are ranked by size on this slide. And you see that the men are the only difference at the genetic level between the female and the male karyotype are for what concerns the sex chromosomes, with females having two X chromosomes and male one X and Y and a Y chromosome. And you can see immediately that these two chromosomes are highly heteromorphic. The X chromosome is quite large and contains approximately 1,000 genes, while with several either specialized and basic functions, while the Y is much smaller and contains approximately 70 genes, which are mostly dedicated to sex determination. And so the evolution of these heteromorphic sex chromosomes from an original pair of autosomes creates a number of disequilibrium, which are recapitulated here. So the first is between the X chromosome and autosome. And if we look at male cells, we see that there's going to be only one copy of this very important X chromosome, while you will have two copies of every other autosomes. The other imbalance is linked to the comparison between males and females because, as I just mentioned, males have one X chromosome while females have two. So there are mechanisms that evolved to compensate these imbalance. And these mechanisms make sure that ultimately one is equal to two and that 1 plus 1 is equal to 1. So that's going to be my only mathematical clin d'œil, I would say. So these are phenomena that exist to compensate this dosage imbalance. And what I'm going to talk mostly about today is the process of X chromosome inactivation. So the presence of 2X induces this imbalance, which is in practice compensated for by the inactivation of one of the two female X chromosomes, so that 1 plus 1 chromosome ultimately equal 1. Well, this is not completely true. Actually, there are some genes that are still expressed from the inactive X chromosome, so that 1 plus 1 is a bit superior to 1, actually. And in humans, there is approximately 20% of the genes that do escape the process of X chromosome inactivation. So I will refer to X chromosome inactivation as XCI for the rest of my talk, so that's what it means. And this X inactivation process occurs in all mammals, so both marsupials and placental mammals. And it's a developmentally regulated process that occurs very early in development. So what I'm showing here are the first steps of mammalian development. So from the fertilization, the first cleavage state, where you have the activation of the zygote genome at different stages depending on the species. And then you have formation of the blastocyst, which is going to implant in the uterus. And then development will proceed with castration and so on. And so X inactivation occurs early in development, but with different kinetics according to the species. So in the mouse, which has been so far the most studied model for X inactivation is initiated right after the activation of the zygotic genome. And I will not go into the details, but it's at this stage imprinted with the paternal X being systematically inactivated. There is a transient phase of reactivation, and then random X inactivation is subsequently initiated upon implantation. And more recently, there was fantastic work from Edis lab that revealed a completely different situation in the human, where X inactivation still occurs quite early. I mean, it's during the embryonic development, the early stage of embryonic development. but not before implantation. And there are still many questions that arise regarding how X-chromosomal activation is established in the human, and that's what I'm going to talk mostly during my talk. What is important about X inactivation is that it is a random process, meaning that it can be either the paternally X chromosome or the maternal X chromosome that can be inactivated. And so there is a decision that is made at some point early in development. And when this decision is made, the process is established, maintained throughout cell division. So that's why it's really a typical epigenetic process where you have a memory of the chromosome that has been initially inactivated. And so you end up with patches, groups of cells in which you have one or the other X chromosome inactivated. And because of that, female mammals are in fact mosaics with half of the body made of cells with the maternal X chromosome inactivated and half of the body made of cells with the paternal X inactivated. And so this mosaicism is a well-known example of X inactivation, which we see in this calico cat, where you have patches of brown or dark patches of fur. But you have to keep in mind that the mosaicism is applying to the entire body, and so all our organs are made of cells with either one or the other X chromosome active. So at the molecular level, X chromosome inactivation is controlled by a specific region of the X chromosome, which is called the X inactivation center, and we've learned that from various translocation that could be observed both in humans and mouse. And thanks to the cloning and sequencing technique, we know now exactly the composition of this X inactivation center, and there's many genes in this region. And as you can see, they are depicted here either in black or in blue. And the difference between the black and the blue is that the blue are genes that will produce long non-coding RNA. So maybe it's not necessary, but I thought I would make a short parenthèse about long non-coding RNA. So the dogma of the molecular biology is that DNA will be transcribed into RNA, and which will be kind of a message that will be translated into proteins. But in fact, what we've realized, thanks to the large-scale genome sequencing, genome and transcriptome sequencing project, is that the actual coding fraction of our genomes is small. It's about 2% of the genome, while in fact, most of the genomes is transcribed. And these give rise to a bunches of non-coding RNAs, and some of which are going to be the subject of this talk, and these are long non-coding RNA, which are artificially, to some extent, categorized as non-coding RNA of more than 200 nucleotides. And what do we know about this long non-coding RNA or long non-coding RNA genes? So they are numerous. There are as many non-coding RNA genes probably as there are protein coding genes. We know the function for only a handful of them. For those, we know that they are involved in the regulation of gene expression at various stages and through various mechanisms. And what is also quite interesting is that they do evolve rapidly, and there's no selective pressure based on the genetic code, so they vary a lot from one species to another. So one of the famous long non-coding RNA, and probably one of the first to be identified, and probably one of the most characterized, is the GZIST long non-coding RNA. So this is, GZIST is a gene, it was actually the first gene that was mapped to this X inactivation center. And this, it produces a long non-coding RNA that stays in the nucleus and that accumulates on the chromosome from which it is expressed. So that's what you can see on these RNA fish images, where you have an X-linked gene that is labeled in, whose RNA is labeled in green. And so the fact that you see two dots shows you that the two X chromosomes are active. And when X chromosome inactivation is initiated, you see GZIST that start to accumulate just on one of the two X, and that's really important. That's what we see in the mouse. And that leads quite rapidly to the transcriptional inactivation of the X chromosome, so that you don't see this dot expressed anymore. So GZIST is essential to the process of X-chromosome inactivation. It is a trigger, and it has been only recently that we began to understand how XIST is working, and that comes from the work of many labs, again, including that of Edith. And what those people have shown is that XIST serves as a recruiting platform for several protein complexes. So XIST will first accumulate around the X chromosome and rapidly recruit a series of complexes that are involved in modifying the chromatin, modifying the nuclear organization, also modifying the RNA, and triggering the silencing of the chromosome. And this will trigger silencing and ensure that the silent state will be stably maintained. And that's what we see here in the form of the bar body, which was described in the late 40s. So this compact heterochromatin foci that is present only in female cells and quite often at the periphery of the nucleus. So XIST is essential. It triggers X chromosome inactivation. And so it is key that the regulation of XIST expression is very well done, so that you make sure that you have only one X that is inactivated and only in female cells. So in the past years, we've been interested in understanding how this regulation was achieved. And I will really give you a brief overview, because we focused a lot on these other long non-coding RNA genes that are present in blue within the X inactivation center. And basically, the take-home message is that, so this is the work of our lab, and so actually there are other names here, so we are not the only one. So I didn't forget to mention the other ones, but they do not show on the screen. And so what I just wanted to say with this slide is that all the other non-coding RNA genes from the X inactivation center somehow contribute to X inactivation via XIST, so they all regulate XIST. What is interesting is that they do so through various mechanisms. So in some cases, it is the long non-coding RNA that is produced from the locus that is important for regulating XIST, whereas in other cases, the non-coding RNA that is produced is dispensable, but it is the act of transcription that is important, either through the recruitment of chromatin-modifying complexes or through an enhancer-like mechanism, which we have not completely unraveled. So to summarize this part, what we know now is that there's really a network of non-coding RNA genes that contribute to X chromosome inactivation, and they have an interesting evolutionary history, which I will not go into today. And so they act by regulating XIST, and some are rather repressors of XIST, and some are activators, and they act through diverse mechanisms. And as you might see, so in this part you have repressor, in this part you have activator, so that these long non-coding RNA genes, they are also segregated based on their function, and they are segregated not only on the linear scale, but also on the 3D scale, and that's what was shown by Elfej Nora in the lab of Edith, is that this region that controls chromosome inactivation is organized into two topological domains. One domain that is rather involved in preventing X inactivation, and the other domain that is rather involved in promoting X chromosome inactivation. So we've learned a lot from the mouse, but when I started my lab quite some years ago, I was really intrigued to understand to what extent this process was conserved in the human. And so, we had very few information about that. One thing that we knew, and that was shown even more recently, is that XIST in the human is able to silence the chromosome from which it is expressed. And so many people, including Edith, has used transgenic approach to study the function of the X inactivation center. So in that case, what the group of Ginny Lawrence has done, it's quite a nice experiment, is that they tackle the question of whether XIST could silence an extra chromosome 21 in a Down syndrome cells. And so what they did was to introduce artificially XIST cDNA. So now we're not talking about regulation of XIST, but really its function. And if you introduce GZIST into one of the three chromosome 21, and if you force the expression of this GZIST CDNX transgene, you end up with an accumulation of GZIST and the silencing of this chromosome, which has, of course, many potential therapeutic applications. So GZIST induces chromosome silencing in human, but not in all contexts. So this is, again, what's something that Edith showed in this 2011 paper. So I showed you previously that X chromosome inactivation in the human occurs after implantation. We are still trying to understand the exact genetics. But what is absolutely striking is that GZIST expression and accumulation starts way before X chromosome inactivation. So as soon as the zygotic genome gets activated, GZIST is expressed, GZIST starts to accumulate and to coat or decorate the two X chromosomes and actually the single X in male cells. What is remarkable is that even though GZIST accumulate in these early stages where the two X's are active, the pattern of GZIST accumulation is quite different from what we see in the somatic cells where GZIST coat an inactive X chromosome. And we see that the accumulation GZIST accumulates in more dispersed pattern, which might be linked to the fact that it's unable to silence at this stage. And we were able to measure this dispersion. So what this is telling us, several things. So first, that in human, which is completely different from what we had learned in the mouse, there is a transient uncoupling between GZIST expression and X chromosome inactivation. It also tells us that the initiation of X chromosome inactivation in human is controlled at the level of GZIST activity, but not at the level of GZIST expression, which is also very different from what is happening in the mouse. So even though X chromosome inactivation is an essential process in mammals, the final stage is reached through a very different routes. And the last observation that these data raise is that X chromosome inactivation seems to occur quite late. So this questions the requirement for dosage compensation in the early stages of embryonic development and also the link to the cellular state. So these are forming the basis of the question that we are trying to address in my lab. And for this, obviously, we need models because we cannot work easily with human embryos. And one of the obvious models to use is the embryonic stem cells. Mouse embryonic stem cells have been instrumental to discover many things about mouse X chromosome inactivation. And so, obviously, human embryonic stem cells could also be very powerful. However, when you derive human embryonic stem cells from embryos, the pattern that you observe in most of the cells is a pattern of post-implantation embryos, even though these cells are derived from pre-implantation embryos. So in those cells, X chromosome inactivation has already occurred. GZIST is accumulating on one of the two X, which is silent. So this is not useful, really, to understand what is going on in the early stage of development. And so recently, there have been numerous labs working on protocols to reset human embryonic stem cells into a naive pluripotent state, which would be resembling much more that of the pre-implantation embryo. And indeed, these protocols allow to get cells with two active X chromosomes, and I will discuss this a bit more later. So we started from this prime pluripotent stem cell, and we tried to understand whether we could identify new regulators of X chromosome inactivation in these cells. And so to do so, we did RNA-seq, nothing very original, but we tried to analyze the data in a different manner. And this led us to the identification of a novel transcript that is quite long. Actually, it's a 250 kilobase locus that is transcribed with a single splicing event. And so this is locus is located completely outside of this X inactivation center region. And why we got interested in this transcript, but that was because when we looked at this the expression of this gene at the single cell level by RNA FISH, we found that this transcript is able to coat the X chromosome, a bit mirroring what cyst is doing, except that it is coating the active X chromosome in this prime embryonic stem cells, while cyst is coating the inactive X chromosome. So it was one of the first long non-coding RNA to display this ability to code the chromosome beside cyst. And the other interesting aspect is that this long non-coding RNA gene is not conserved. So usually we see conservation as a proof of function, and we try to take the opposite view. I still don't know whether we were right or not, but we took this bet. And in fact, so this long non-coding RNA gene is specific to hominoids, and it emerged through the integration of transposable elements specifically in the hominoid lineage. And so we thought that this species specificity might be linked to species-specific features of X chromosome inactivation. So then we faced with this problem. How can we address the role of EXACT? So for this, we used three different system model, I would say. One is trying to do a kind of a quick and dirty experiment in a heterologous system with mouse ES cells. So the question is, what happens if we introduce EXACT, which is not present in the mouse? Does it change something in terms of X inactivation? Then the other question is, okay, we've identified this transcript in cells in culture. Does it have any relevance in human embryos? So that's why we worked also with human embryos obtained from in vitro fertilization and donated for research. And the other is these naive ES cells which mimic the early stages of human development. So in order to test the function of EXACT in this heterologous system, what we did was to artificially introduce a part of EXACT, not the entire locus, because it's really huge, but at least the promoter region and a huge part of it. And we forced the insertion into one of the two X chromosomes of female mouse ES cells. So that's what is represented here. And the question we ask is, what happens during differentiation? So when you work with mouse ES cells, you're quite lucky because they have two active X chromosomes, and when you differentiate, you observe a random X inactivation with either one or the other X being inactivated. And the question we asked was whether the presence of EXACT would change anything regarding the randomness of X chromosome inactivation, and the answer is yes. Indeed, there is a bias toward the inactivation of the wild-type X, which can be interpreted as EXACT is somehow preventing or impairing the accumulation of cyst and the X chromosome. So this is an interesting result, but it's completely, artificial. So obviously it doesn't prove anything regarding the function of EXACT. So what we did next was to look at human embryos. So we took advantage of single-cell RNA-seq data that were available. So different set of data, which led us with a lot of cells. And what we could observe with this data is that indeed EXACT is expressed in human embryo, and its expression starts right after the activation of the zygotic genome. And actually, its pattern follows that of cyst, so there is expression of EXACT in the embryo. And when we compare the expression of EXACT and cyst at the single cell level, we see that their expression is highly correlated. So meaning that there seems to be maybe, I don't know, co-regulated, even though they are localized very far away, but EXACT is the gene that shows the most correlation with cyst in the early human development. So we have two long non-coding RNA that are able to code the chromosome from which it is expressed, from which they are expressed, and which are expressed in the same cell. So how can they deal with this, and what happens in the nuclear space? So we studied that by RNA FISH in collaboration with Catherine Patra and Edith. And what we could see is that indeed these two long non-coding RNA genes are expressed, and the RNA accumulate on the two X chromosomes. So you see EXACT and cyst in cells of a blastocyst. And what we could see is that there was never any overlap between the two signals, so that they are kind of either contacting completely different regions or repulsing one another. We don't know that yet. but they are expressed from each chromosome, but in a non-overlapping manner. So what we know so far is that XACT is expressed in early embryo. Actually, the expression of XACT is turned down when differentiation proceeds, so it's really restricted to early development with some exception. So its expression correlates with that of GIST, suggesting co-regulation, co-function. I mean, we have no idea yet. And the fact that they co-accumulate on active X and based on the results that we obtain in the heterologous system, we wonder whether XACT could modulate the function of GIST, the ability of GIST to silence the chromosome, or whether it does anything else or anything at all. So to address this, then we had to turn, we cannot do any functional studies in human embryos, so we had to turn to these naive embryonic stem cells that do supposedly mimic the early human development. And so this is what we have in those cells. So the first thing is that indeed the X chromosomes are active in human ESL, the two X chromosomes, so you can see that by RNA FISH. So this time, this is the X-linked gene at TRX in red, and you see that in all cells, there is two, or almost all cells, there is two signals of at TRX. What is not fully equivalent to the embryo, though, is the fact that while in the embryo you have exist on the two X's, in all cells, in these naive cells, you have this pattern in 10% of the cells. And in the remaining cells, you have exist only on one of the two X, because this is not silencing in this case. We have looked at the activity of the X chromosome not at the level of a single gene, because this is just, it doesn't tell us the whole story, but we've looked at polymorphism on the X chromosome, and so this enabled us to measure whether the genes were expressed from only one X or for two X's, and so in primed ES cells, there is very few genes that are expressed from the two X chromosomes, and those are the genes that escape X chromosome inactivation. But when you go, when you look in naive cells, naive human embryonic stem cells, most of the genes that we could analyze through the SNPs are biallelic, indeed confirming that the two X chromosomes are active. So what about XACT? So we could find kind of the same pattern that was observed in the embryo, with XACT accumulating on the two X chromosomes in these naive human embryonic stem cells, and on the chromosome on which it co-accumulates with GIST, again, we see a completely different non-overlapping pattern of the two non-coding RNA. What we also observed is that even though XACT is expressed in those cells, what I'm showing here is RNA-seq track from the region. It seems to be expressed as a different isoform, and it might be using an alternative promoters to start its expression in naive cells, which is a reason why it was really difficult for us to obtain exact knockout cells, because each time we would delete a promoter, there was another one that was taking off. So anyway, I'm almost done. So you won't have the answer about the exact function, unfortunately for you, and fortunately for me and for us. But we now have the set of tools that really allow us to address a lot of questions and which form the basis of the ERC project. So we do have naive human embryonic stem cells that do recapitulate, not perfectly, but at least to a large extent, what is happening in early embryos. And so obviously we have wild-type cells, but we have tools to create a lot of mutants, and we have already lots of mutant cells for XACT, GIST, any long non-coding RNA that we are interested in. And with this system, we can ask many questions. So one is, what prevents GIST from silencing the chromosome at this stage? Is there factors that are missing? Is there factors that are here and that prevent GIST? So that's the question we're asking. Then we can induce these cells to differentiate and put them in the primed state again. So this is called repriming. And with this event, now we can ask how X chromosome inactivation is initiated. What makes the change in GIST activity? Because GIST is expressed, and at one stage it's silenced, and while before it was not silencing. There's also a change in GIST expression, because here you had expression of GIST from the two X's, while here you have expression from only one X. And what is also interesting is that you can go toward like embryonic lineage, and you can also go toward trophoblast stem cells, and this allow you to ask whether X chromosome inactivation is initiated with different mechanisms, different kinetics, and so on, depending on the lineage. And another aspect in which we are interested is to understand what happens later. So how stable is the inactive state whilst established? And we can also take advantage of these human embryonic stem cells to push differentiation further into different lineages. And we are particularly interested in the hematopoietic lineage and also in the intestine. So we are also using intestine organoids to interrogate how X chromosome inactivation is maintained in complex tissues and organs, whether they are also lineage-specific features, and whether there is a link to the cellular state where X chromosome inactivation being maybe more flexible in adult stem cells, for instance, compared to fully differentiated cells. So these are the type of questions that we are going to address in humans. And we are also interested in understanding the variability in X chromosome inactivation mechanism and dynamics across primates. So far, what I've shown you is that there are quite some differences between human and mouse, but these two have diverged 90 million years ago. So this is a while, and we are really interested in understanding how flexible is our epigenetic process across a more limited timescale. And so we're studying X chromosome inactivation in rhesus monkey and chimp, which diverge from human much more recently. And in fact, we know already from our work, but also from work that is going to be published soon, that there are already quite significant differences between rhesus and human primates. And so I'm going to stop here. I would like to thank my wonderful colleagues and also past members who contributed to this work, and some of our collaborators, which are listed here. Not all of them are listed here. Our sponsors, and obviously you for keeping with me all this time. Thank you very much.